This show is brought to you by Gobble by Kevin Carr, a Thanksgiving novelette of the zombie apocalypse, and you thought your family dinner was stressful. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Today's show, in the first post-Thanksgiving show, we have horror movies and love stories. A bizarre mix of things you wouldn't necessarily expect right after Thanksgiving in the heart of the holiday season. But that's what we got in the cinemas this week. The movies that these include are Incarnate, Man Down, The Eyes of My Mother, Loving, and The Love Witch. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and of course the home cinema roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The only news story that I'm really going to cover right now is the Critics' Choice Movie Awards. The nominations came out. And the reason I'm sort of concentrating on that is because I'm actually a voting member of this. I was allowed to nominate. I'm going to be allowed to vote on who wins. And you can tune in yourself Sunday night, December 11th. That's next Sunday night at 8 o'clock Eastern, 5 o'clock Pacific on A&E. It's hosted by TJ Miller. You get to see the Critics' Choice Movie Awards. And this year they've been moved up. Usually they're in January. So they're kind of early this year. And I think that's just more because of Christmas falling on a Sunday and just sort of like the schedule of how to book a Sunday night gig on television. So instead of having them in January, we're going to have them in December, which is kind of a shame, partly because certain movies are left out, which I'll talk about in a little bit. You know, stuff like Silence and even like Collateral Beauty. I don't know if that would have gotten it. I didn't get a chance to see that early enough for Passengers. Star Wars even. Now, Star Wars last year caused a bit of a stir because we had nominations in middle of December and they didn't show Star Wars yet. And that was the only movie that wasn't shown to the critics. And so the membership retroactively gave it a nomination. It didn't win for like Best Picture. I personally think that if you're going to be giving out end of the year awards, you should see all the movies of the year. And if a studio's not ready to show you something until the last week or two of the year, you should accommodate that. This push to have these awards too early are kind of silly because it leaves stuff out. You can't say that, for example, last year, a lot like New York Film Circle or National Board of Review, not that they would have said Star Wars was the best movie of the year, but they weren't even given a chance to see it. So you can't definitively say that whatever they pick is the best movie of the year. It's sort of like, well, this is the best movie of the year for the ones that we saw, even though this movie came in well into 2015. So that was my issue last year. This year it's a little earlier. Hopefully we'll get back into January next year. I think it makes for an easier award season, much easier to nominate. Then I'm not scrambling right before Thanksgiving to watch everything. But the big winners in terms of nominations, La La Land got the most. It got 12. And then Arrival and Moonlight both got 10 nominations. Now, I thought La La Land is a perfectly charming movie. I'll talk more about that next week. And Arrival, I was okay with Arrival. I think Arrival kind of falls apart if you think too much about it. But I thought it was sort of this thing that appealed to people who kind of looked down on science fiction. So it's sort of like a science fiction story for people who can rise above science fiction. And then finally, Moonlight, I think, was a fascinating movie simply because of the approach it took. And it's great to see a movie that does deal with LGBT issues and some African-American issues as well, getting such mainstream attention, which is great. I'm not going to go through the whole list. You can find it. Go to criticschoice.com and you can check out the full nominations list. I was happy to see, though, Hacksaw Ridge get a nomination for Best Picture, as was Sully, which are two of my favorite movies of this year. Good to see Casey Affleck get a nomination for Manchester by the Sea as Best Actor. And of course, Tom Hanks in Sully. And everything else seems to fall very much into place. You'd expect Natalie Portman to get nominated for Jackie. The one piece of acting nomination that I do want to sort of call attention to, which I thought I kind of rolled my eyes at. It was for Best Supporting Actress in an Action Movie. And I know you're limiting it by saying it's an action movie, because there's not a whole lot of great roles in action movies out there for women. And so you get stuff like Scarlett Johansson in Civil War and Margot Robbie in Suicide Squad, who I think was bang on in Suicide Squad. She was actually really good. I wasn't a big fan of that movie, but I thought she was great in it. But we nominated Gal Gadot for Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice, which, I mean, great. That's fine. You know, I liked Batman versus Superman probably more than most people did, but she didn't act a whole lot in it. She just sort of fought a lot. She had like 10 lines in the movie. So you get some silly, silly things. I like the fact that Critics Choice breaks out best action movie, best comedy, best sci-fi or horror film, because I think a lot of these things get swept under the rug. Where else are you going to see Central Intelligence get nominated for anything? And that was kind of a fun little movie. I actually feel really good about the list. I've seen most of the movies. There are a couple of them that squeaked in there that I haven't seen yet. Most of them foreign films, I have to admit. But at this point, I'm actually very excited to see who wins when I get to actually cast my ballot next week in the Critics' Choice Movie Awards. Like I said, you can see that for yourself on Sunday night, December 11th at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific on A&E. And you'll see if my choices that you've heard me talk about throughout the year actually make it to the top of the list. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the trailer park. The first film I want to talk about is Silence by Martin Scorsese. It opens on December 23rd.
Ferreira is lost to us. He denounced God in public and surrendered the faith.
That's not possible. Father Ferreira risked his life to spread our faith all over Japan.
It seems to me that our mission here is more urgent than ever. We must go find Father Ferreira.
The moment you set foot in that country, you step into high danger.
The price for your glory is their suffering.
Dangerous.
We asked for this mission.
I'm a huge fan of Martin Scorsese, but I have to admit I don't like all of his movies. For every movie like The Departed, there's a movie like Bringing Out the Dead, which I don't think works at all. But he's got some fantastic movies. Now, Silence is a passion project for him. It's about missionaries going into Japan, and you know it's going to be about culture clash and religious differences. And I think that comes really interesting because Martin Scorsese is a Catholic and he has such overbearing Catholic themes visually in his films. So it'll be interesting to see how he handles it. This is a problem though here. Silence has almost been seen by nobody at this point. There was a screening at the Vatican and apparently there was a very limited screening. National Board of Review got to see it. They gave it Best Screenplay. But it missed the New York Film Critics Circle, any sort of nominations, and the BFCA, no nominations there for the Critics' Choice Movie Awards. Why? Probably because it's not done yet. We saw that with Wolf of Wall Street a couple years ago by Martin Scorsese. Apparently, he was making changes right to the very end. And I think we also saw that possibly with Hateful Eight last year, and certainly with Selma that was being wrapped up, that actually missed a couple nominations. And that's a shame because Selma was a great movie. But I'm looking forward to Silence. I'm probably going to have to go see it between Christmas and New Year's because I don't think they're going to show it to us. They just don't have it completely out there yet. The next one I want to talk about is a teaser for The Mummy. A full trailer comes out this weekend, which you can get online. But right now we just have the teaser to it.
I saw her. She is real.
The one thing you don't get from this, you do get a little bit of it from the sound, is you hear Tom Cruise in there. Second thing is, if you actually watch the trailer, it looks like it's going to be very heavy on the CGI, which you saw with the 1999 remake of The Mummy. I'm curious to see how this turns out because it just looks like a lot of CGI that appears unnecessary in the teaser alone. So will we have a good story behind it? Will this reboot the Universal Monsters the way they want it to that Dracula Untold did not? I do not have 100% faith in that. But we'll see come next summer. That's it for this segment. Next segment, I'm going to be talking about love with Loving and the Love Witch. Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
I'm too sexy for my shirt. Too sexy for my shirt. So sexy it hurts.
Hello, welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies. I'm using my Barry White voice because we're going to be talking about love in this section of Fat Guys at the Movies. I don't know whether that was sexy or not. I'm thinking it was not. I'm thinking that's the sort of thing you hear that sends women screaming and running for the hills. It makes little children cry and men laugh. So my apologies to those who ran for the hills and cried, and my tip of the hat to anybody who got a good laugh out of that, because that was me being sexy. I am a sexy beast. If I try to be too sexy, it doesn't work. I just have to be myself. I have to be Kevin Carr, fat guy at the movies, and just sort of let my lusciousness go out there into the universe and get all the love back. And speaking of love, let's talk about some movies that are going to be about love. The first one I want to talk about is Loving. An interracial couple fights prejudice and segregation laws in Virginia after they get married in the 1950s.
I'm going to take Mildred up to D.C. to get married.
Are you sure about that?
Richard Perry Loving, being a white person, and Mildred Jeter, being a colored person, did unlawfully cohabitate as man and wife.
Richard?
It ain't right!
I believe this is a battle that could go all the way to the Supreme Court.
We ain't hurting anybody.
The state of Virginia will argue that it is unfair to bring children of mixed race into the world.
You may know that this movie's been out for a while. It's one of those movies that got that 20 theater release, then it expanded, and they never really screened it where I was from, which is Columbus, Ohio. And it's out there, and it's a significant movie to talk about. It's gotten some nominations. In fact, Critics' Choice Movie Awards, it got a couple nominations there. So it's a significant movie to talk about. It just, it never really fit on the schedule because the release date was so awkward. And you see that a lot. We got a whole bunch of them we're going to be talking about in the next couple of weeks. Stuff like Jackie, for example, opened this week in very limited runs in some cities. Next week, it's going to be expanding. I really don't know when to cover it because, you know, I want to talk about stuff that you can then go and see in the movie theater. I don't want to talk about a movie that you got to wait 3 weeks to go see. So that's why I didn't cover Loving earlier. But let's talk about Loving now. And I'm going to talk about the elephant in the room right now because of the Oscar So White controversy last couple of years, and particularly last year, there seems to be an awful lot of movies this year that are up for award contention that feature African Americans in particular. You've got Fences, you've got Loving. They tried to go with Birth of a Nation, but there's plenty of other ones to choose from. You've got a Collateral Damage, which is, of course, Will Smith's attempt to get an Oscar. I guess we have to nominate him this year for the Oscar, or Jada Pinkett Smith is going to boycott the Oscars again. Loving falls into that category where it deals directly with a racial issue. Hidden Figures is the same way. What's funny is I saw in a very small period of time, I saw Loving, Hidden Figures, and Jackie, all three of which take place either late. Oh, and also The Founder, which has nothing to do with black people, but you know, it takes place in the 50s and 60s. So all these movies took place kind of in the same era. And it's sort of odd because that seems to be where they're concentrating, whether they're talking about racial issues like Loving does or Hidden Figures, or if it's about like The Founder, which it just happens to take place, or Jackie, it happens to take place in the early 60s. This seems to be the theme this year. And Loving is one of those that allows the Academy to see in a very safe way and nominate people of color in the awards this year. What's nice about it is you don't have that one that's going to just run away because it's dealing with African-American subject matter. I mean, you don't have Birth of a Nation sitting out there in a vacuum. you've got all these other movies in competition. But anyways, Loving is directed by Jeff Nichols, and he did movies like Midnight Special. He did Mud, which is my favorite movie of his. He also did Take Shelter. And his filmmaking approach is to tell the story around the story, if you see that in a lot of his films, in particularly Midnight Special. Midnight Special is about a kid who's got to some weird connection with aliens. But it's not, never really deals with that. It deals with all the, his father and his mother and the people who are trying to save him. It sort of skirts around the big issue there. And they kind of do that with this movie. It all skirts around. It's not about a Supreme Court fight. In fact, they're not even in the courtroom when they have this big Supreme Court battle in the movie. It's about the everyday life of the people around you. Now, I'm not a big fan of that. I think that's a little bit reductive in terms of filmmaking, but that's how Jeff Nichols works. And if you like Jeff Nichols stuff, you get that in this movie. It's well acted, and it deals with real pragmatic issues that are shockingly only about 50 years old. And that's horrifying when you think about it, that we're just that far away from you not being able to marry a person because of race. That's just kind of terrifying. But this is a reality in history, and it's a well-made film, and it does present the issue. And I think that's the strength of Jeff Nichols, because it doesn't deal with a supernatural element like Take Shelter or Midnight Special. I think that makes it a better movie. So I'm going to have to say Loving kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Love Witch. Oh, yeah. See, there they go, running for the hills again. Children are weeping. This is the effect I have on America. Thank you very much, people. Anyways, The Love Witch is a tribute to 60s cinema that follows the story of a witch who moves to a new town and tinkers with love spells on various men.
What do men want?
Just a pretty woman to love and to take care of them.
Love me. Love me.
What I'm really interested in is love. You might say I'm addicted to love.
Witchcraft is just a way of concentrating energy. It can only work with what's already there. I just use sex magic to create love magic.
This, in some ways, reminds me of the movie The Editor, which came out a couple years ago, and that was a tribute to giallo horror. That was a movie that was shot like a giallo horror movie. If you've not seen giallo horror, that was Italian filmmaking that often has some heavy violence to it. And it's like Mario Bava, Lucio Fulci. You got people like that who did a giallo horror. And there's a lot of giallo out there, but it's always horror movies that have a certain feel to them. And The Editor was a tribute to that. And in a way, it was more interesting if you know anything about giallo. That made The Editor more interesting than it was as just a standalone piece. If you'd never seen giallo horror, you didn't get the movie. This one deals with sort of that tribute to 60s filmmaking as well, but there was this rash of movies of people tinkering with witchcraft. And that's what this is a tribute to. This is a tribute to those movies. Now, it's shot brilliantly. The costume design and the lighting, it looks like it was shot in the 60s, to the point that you could almost watch part of it and wonder if this was in fact a lost 60s film. I mean, the art of the design of this movie makes it work. Now, as a movie itself, it's not a great movie. It's not a knee slapper comedy. It's not a terrifying horror movie, but it's not meant to be, because these movies back in the day weren't like that either. It's just a very good emulation of those. And the biggest complaint I have is there are times where they break the chronological barrier. You see people driving modern cars, and it's very jarring because the rest of the movie, everybody's in sort of 60s attire, 60s makeup, 60s lighting. Another scene where somebody pulls out a cell phone and uses it, which just seems so odd. But overall, if you've ever seen those movies of 60s pop looking for more meaning to life, you'll appreciate this movie. And that's why I have to say The Love Witch kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. Time to jump into the horror movies next with Incarnate and The Eyes of My Mother.
Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. It is the first weekend of December, and you know that means, no, not Christmas, it means horror movies, apparently. I love horror movies, don't get me wrong. I'm a huge fan of horror movies, as everybody knows. But horror movies seem more relevant in October. I remember it was either last year or the year before they did that Victor Frankenstein movie with James McAvoy playing Frankenstein and Daniel Radcliffe playing Igor. And that wasn't a bad movie, but it came out like the week before Thanksgiving. And it just got buried. No one wants to see a horror movie this time of year. No, I mean, there are people who do. Don't get me wrong. There's horror aficionados who will watch a horror movie on Christmas morning if they could. But just in terms of mainstream audience, nobody cares about this stuff. A couple of years ago, there was a movie called The Pyramid. Came out first weekend of December. Do you remember that movie? Of course you don't. It was a horror movie. First weekend of December. It was found footage crap about people going into a pyramid. I never even saw it. This one I saw, I had to, because it was really the only new movie that's out there. And it just seems silly to release a horror movie this time. I mean, at least wait, either do it a couple months earlier in October or do it in January, which tends to be heavy with horror movies as well, but usually crappy ones. And this one would fit in there. And the reason that they release these movies at this time is they don't want to compete against whatever the big movie was over Thanksgiving. It's always a big release on Thanksgiving. Last week, it was Moana. Moana cleaned up the box office. It was a tidal wave just taking in all the money. Nobody wanted to go up against Moana in its second weekend, especially not a family film. That's why they go and do something that's so totally 180 degrees out of phase with something like Moana. So it seems like a good idea on paper, but it's not. Anyways, let's talk about Incarnate. Aaron Eckhart plays a wheelchair-bound parapsychologist who evicts demons from people's minds by entering their thoughts.
I have an archdemon possessing the body of an innocent 11-year-old boy. Of course, we sent in the best exorcists, but they failed.
Who are you?
I'm gonna help your son. I don't do exorcisms. I don't use religious methods to treat the symptoms. I go inside the victim's mind to treat the disease. I evict the demon from the inside.
I actually took my son to see this. We had seen another screening right before it, and then I didn't have time to take him home. So I said, hey, you're coming with me to this crappy horror movie. And my son was like, hey, this is like Inception. And he's right. It does remind me a bit of Inception because they're sort of entering people's minds. And in this one, he talks about demons and possession, putting the people in a dreamlike state. But it really reminds me more of the movie Cell, not the Stephen King story with John Cusack that I reviewed a couple months ago. I'm talking about the one from the early 2000s with Jennifer Lopez and Vincent D'Onofrio and Vince Vaughn, where Vincent D'Onofrio was a killer and Jennifer Lopez was able to go inside his mind to try and connect with him. So it's a used idea. It's something we've seen before, albeit, you know, almost 15 years ago. Overall, the idea is fine, but the execution of this movie is terrible. It is predictable. I saw everything coming. The acting is really pretty bad. Aaron Eckhart is just making a paycheck. He had a crappy January horror movie-ish called I, Frankenstein a couple years ago. And it's like he said, well, you know, I did a crappy January one. I'll do a crappy December horror movie. And I think he's going to work backwards. Now, in the movie's defense, it was, I think, supposed to come out originally the end of September, but they bumped the release date. But I don't blame him necessarily because he's just collecting a paycheck and you only are as good as the role you're given. A great actor can take a good role and make it great. But the best actor in the world can't take a terrible, crummy role and make it decent. He's just given crap. And part of the problem is there's nothing really happens in the movie. This kid's possessed, but he's just sort of sitting in a room.
this kid's not doing it. Not even like The Exorcist, where in The Exorcist, Reagan is in danger. You know, she's deteriorating physically. And it's very terrifying. This one, the kid's just sort of sitting in a room. Just looks like he's playing video games. I struggled to stay awake with this movie. It was so boring. It got so repetitive. The only way this movie could have been worse is if it were a found footage movie. It is an absolute piece of garbage. Incarnate sucks.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about another horror film. And this actually is also new. It's from Magnet Pictures, The Eyes of My Mother. A young girl is twisted after her mother's murdered, sending her on a lifelong path of violence and dependency.
Is this your mother?
Yes.
What did she do?
She was a surgeon in Portugal.
What kind?
Eyes. We used to do the sections together. I remember I was fascinated by how the inside of the body looked. She always hoped I would be a surgeon one day.
The horror field in general, especially recently, we're seeing stuff happen in the last 10 years or so that reminds me of what happened with horror in the 70s. And in the 70s, you had these things called video nasties, which were movies that were meant to be as shocking as possible. A lot of this you saw because of the final dying gasps of the Hays Code. They could make movies, and there were underground movies that they were able to distribute without having to go through the MPAA or anything like that. And that's how you got movies like The Hills Have Eyes, Last House on the Left, I Spit on Your Grave, Cannibal Holocaust, these movies that were meant to be the most shocking movies ever. And they were, especially back in the 70s. Now you can watch something like Cannibal Holocaust. It seems a little goofy. I Spit on Your Grave can still be shocking, but again, sort of, it's a victim of its own era. And in the 2000s, you started seeing this happen again with the advent of VOD distribution that has gone beyond the local video stores. A lot of blockbusters wouldn't release unrated or NC-17 rated content, but now you can get anything you really want. And you have direct disc distribution through the internet, but especially VOD. And you started seeing stuff come in from other countries like Martyrs from France, Inside from France. You had all the Takashi Miike stuff coming in from Japan. So you saw some pretty extreme stuff coming in from international horror. And then you started having either domestic horror or just modern horror saying, let's make the most offensive thing possible. That's how you get movies like The Human Centipede or a Serbian film. And I was never a big fan of that. I mean, there's a couple movies out there now that are swirling around stuff like Night of Something Strange or We Are the Flesh, which are known as the most disturbing stuff today. I've never been a big fan of that. I've never been a somebody who's been like, show me something really shocking. I want to see rape and murder and dismemberment on the screen for the reason just to watch human misery. But I can appreciate a well-made movie. And The Eyes of My Mother is easily one of the most disturbing movies I've seen in a while that doesn't put all the stuff on the screen. And that's actually a benefit to the movie. It's a very slow burn. It's about this girl who grows up with these traumatic childhood events that shape her into a monster herself. And it takes its time. And when stuff happens, it's paced in such a way that shocking things happen. You're not surprised that they're happening. But it's only after they happen that you sit there and think, oh, hold on, that's kind of unnerving. Now it's very little on-screen violence. There's on-screen violence, but a lot of it's implied, which is a great technique filmmakers have used for years to show that what you imagine and what you can remember is worse than anything you see. You saw that in Texas Chainsaw Massacre. You don't see the on-screen violence in that movie necessarily, but everyone remembers it. These kind of off-screen stuff that make people remember stuff that they never saw. And that's what I think The Eyes of My Mother does. So if you want to be unnerved in a very safe environment, check this out. It's short. It's like 75 minutes. It's not a long movie, but it's disturbing, but not obnoxiously in your face disturbing, but it'll stick with you. And that's why I'm going to say The Eyes of My Mother rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Man Down, the box office, and the home cinema roundup. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies for the final segment, where I still have a movie review yet to come and a couple other tidbits and fun stuff before I let you go for the week. First, let's talk about our final review for the week, and that is Man Down. Shia LaBeouf, whatever Shia's name is, he plays a Marine vet who is searching for his son in a post-apocalyptic future.
We got this. He's my battle buddy. We kicked in doors together. We took enemy fire. It's just not a relationship you'd understand if you haven't been through it, I guess.
Is there a reason you don't want to discuss what you saw in that room?
What happened in that room is real. I can't take that back.
You don't hear any post-apocalyptic stuff in that trailer. It's a terrible trailer. Let's just call a spade a spade. This is a bad trailer for this movie. Sometimes I see trailers and I do not understand what they're thinking. It's almost like they have a list. They say, okay, we need to put a song in there. We need to have these moments and these surprises in the trailer. If you actually watch the whole trailer, it gives stuff away. If you're going to bother to see this movie, don't go watch the trailer. Anyways, this is the first real spotlight on Shia LaBeouf that I've seen. I mean, he was in the movie American Honey, but he wasn't the star of that. But this is the first movie I've seen him do since his real complete breakdown that was meant to be his and his alone, something completely on his shoulders. And I don't know why he keeps getting work, because, I mean, he's not a bad actor, but I think his goodwill is all gone. And I don't think he comes across as very heroic in anything he does. They want him to be a hero, but it doesn't work. He should play like a bad guy. You know, and it's funny because I just saw recently, I can't really talk about, I saw Office Christmas Party, and Jennifer Aniston's in that. And it reminds me of the role that she has in that. It reminds me of Horrible Bosses. I've never been a Jennifer Aniston fan, but boy, when she plays a role like in Horrible Bosses, she's actually really good in those roles. She's good as like the bad guy or mean or the biatch, so to speak. She works in those roles, even though they want her to be a hero. They want her to be the good guy in a lot of the movies. And I feel the same way about Shia LaBeouf. Shia LaBeouf could be an epic bad guy, but they're always trying to give him hero roles. And that's why I think his stuff doesn't quite work. And that's why he just leaves a bad taste in people's mouths. He doesn't come across as a heroic figure. He's not charismatic in that way, the way, say, Will Smith works as a good guy. Tom Hanks works as a good guy and sometimes fails when they play bad guys. At its core, Man Down is about military service. And it frames itself in what it thinks is being an understanding light, but it's not. And it reminds me of a lot of the movies that we saw come out right after the Iraq War started, like 10, 15 years ago. Or right as the buildup was happening, post 9/11 movies, stuff like Grace Is Gone, Stop Loss, Lions for Lambs, these movies where Hollywood's making them and they really don't understand the mindset of the American soldier or the American Marine or the American sailor or the American airman or the American Coast Guard. It's sort of like they read it in a book. So it has this very weird red state, middle America machismo that isn't terribly accurate. It's sort of like they're saying, let's just shave the beards off of the Duck Dynasty guys and make a movie out of them. And that's not the American military. I mean, there are some people like that, sure. But the American military is as diverse and as widespread and as deep and as long as Americans are. It has a vast array of different types of people, and they're not all Bubba's out there having a barbecue. But this movie sort of approaches it in that light. It also tries to tackle the issue of PTSD. And PTSD is a real thing. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. It's a real thing. And having PTSD does not make you weak at all. PTSD is a very normal human reaction to the horrors and decisions that are made and the events that happen in times of combat. There's ugly stuff that happens that our men and women in uniform have to process. And PTSD is a result of that. PTSD is like a bruise. If you get hit with something and you bruise, that doesn't mean you're weak. That's the body's reaction to it. And you have to heal that bruise. And if you don't effectively heal that bruise, you're going to cause problems for yourself. And so what's happening is people are being injured psychologically, and they need to process it and heal and do what needs to be done to make themselves whole again. And this movie's trying to bring light to that subject. The problem is it does so from a stand of ignorance, and it does so from a stand of an ivory pillar saying, I need to make it as extreme as possible. It goes so big with the PTSD that it becomes ridiculous, that it makes anybody who comes back from combat look like such a head case that they can't even tie their shoes in the morning. And there are some real problems with our vets coming home with PTSD, vets becoming homeless, vets committing suicide. These are real issues, but they're not as big and grand and sweeping and sensational as they make them in this movie. It's one of the things I liked about the movie American Sniper. It dealt with PTSD as a real factor, but it was in a very pragmatic, realistic, everyday life sort of thing. Not everybody who has PTSD is going to go completely bonkers. Yes, some people go completely bonkers. That happens. But the way they approach this, the way they paint PTSD, is kind of insulting. And that's one of the reasons I didn't like this movie. And part of it's because it's an acting showpiece for Shia LaBeouf. But in being that acting showpiece, it marginalizes and trivializes the actual effects of what happens. And that's at the core what this movie's about. And so at the core, this movie, I think, is misguided, at least a little bit. So I'm going to have to say, ultimately, while its heart's in the right place, it's not terribly effective in trying to do what it wants to do. So I'm going to have to say that Man Down kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. Last week, I said that Moana was probably on track for 70 to 80 million for the 5-day, 45 for the 3-day. Actually did better in the 3-day at 56 million over the weekend itself. 82 million from its Wednesday night, well, technically Tuesday night opening. That's fantastic. I don't think that's a complete record, but it's up there. Disney's having a banner year. Already Disney has the top 4 slots for worldwide 2016 box office. That's Captain America Civil War, Finding Dory, Zootopia, and The Jungle Book. Secret Life of Pets is right under that, but here's the thing. You got Doctor Strange, which is still out in theaters and still going strong with $619 million. If it just makes $250 million, about $250 million more, it's going to be at number 5. And then we've got this little thing called Star Wars. Now, I'm not saying Star Wars is going to be a $2 billion movie like last year's Star Wars. But if it happens to be a great film, Disney can conceivably end this year with the top 4, 5, or 6 highest grossing movies worldwide of the year. That's impressive for any studio. And you have a lot to thank. You have all the acquired properties, Marvel, Pixar, and Lucasfilm. but you also have Zootopia and the Jungle Book, which are as inherently Disney as Disney. So we'll see what happens as things wrap up by the end of the year. This week, I think it's going to be Moana again at the top of the box office. I'm looking for 25 to 30 million. I think it's going to hold pretty well. Incarnate's not even going to crack five. It's just not. It's nobody cares about that movie. And it's terrible to be. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll in the home cinema roundup. Couple big ones we spoke about Disney. Pete's Dragon is out. That's a wonderful little movie. A great remake to a fun movie, but they stripped out all the child slavery stuff and still made it charming and warm and very Disney. There's also the BFG, which is one of the flops that Disney had this summer. I think it works better in the context of a holiday sense. So that is available. You've got Absolutely Fabulous, the movie, which was a lot of fun. I had to let the series grow on me a little bit, but I thought the movie knocked it out of the park. There's also Don't Breathe, which is a great thriller. Worth checking out if you like something a little bit scary. And then there's The Wildlife and White Girl, which are also available on DVD and Blu-ray to check out. That is it for this week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about a lot of movies, including Office Christmas Party, and probably a little bit about movies like La La Land, Jackie, Miss Sloan, Nocturnal Animals, and Manchester by the Sea. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.